Section 4, The Beginning of the Civil Rights Movement. As you read, look for Modest Beginnings of the Civil Rights Movement in the 1930s and 1940s, Elmore versus Rice and the End of the All-White Primary, Incidences of White-on-Black Violence in South Carolina, The Rise of the Dixiecrats and the White Citizens' Councils, Court Victories for School Desegregation and the Responses of White Carolinians, both against and for the decisions, Terms, Dixiecrat Party, Southern Manifesto, White Citizens' Councils. The story of the civil rights movement in South Carolina started in the 1940s, but there were stirrings earlier. One could argue that there has been some movement for minority civil rights for as long as there has been an American nation, and certainly since emancipation. But those early demands had little impact on the modern movement of the 1940s and 1950s. Stirrings in the 1930s. African Americans in the 1930s were becoming more vocal about their conditions, and for good reasons. South Carolina schools spent about 5 times as much per white pupil as per black pupil. White teachers were paid about 3 times as much as black teachers. Unequal and segregated education was only one cause of discontent. Police brutality and exclusion from elections, good jobs, parks, pools, and restaurants were sources of frustration and anger. During the decade, the NAACP grew from 3 branches, Columbia, Charleston, and Greenville, to 8 branches with about 800 members. Another organized response to Jim Crow abuse was the new Southern Women for the Prevention of Lynching. They argued that white women did not need lynching to protect them from black men. The activism of the 1930s bore little immediate fruit. Accomplishments in the 1940s. In South Carolina, membership in the NAACP increased from 800 to 14,237 in the decade of the 1940s, and branches were organized statewide. World War II contributed to that increased activism. Many returning black servicemen and a few whites were unwilling to passively accept the conditions of the past. Also responsible for the growth were Reverend J. M. Hinton and Monjeska Monteith Simkins, who insisted that NAACP membership was a mark of citizenship. Hinton, an inspirational speaker, was president of the State Conference of NAACP from 1941 to 1958. Monjeska Simkins held various positions in the NAACP over several decades. She was probably considered by the South Carolina establishment as the most pesky and persistent advocate for change of the Jim Crow system. Activist teachers in Charleston challenged the school board's unequal pay policy in 1943 and 1944. South Carolina was introduced to Thurgood Marshall, the NAACP Legal Defense Fund's lawyer who visited the state many times over the next decade. Marshall, later appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court, presented the case in court for the black teachers. U.S. District Judge J. Wades Waring, a member of a prominent Charleston family, ordered the board to equalize pay over the next 2 years. A year later, Judge Waring issued a similar order in a Columbia case. Waring was on his way to becoming a hero to blacks and civil rights advocates. He was soon shunned by his former friends and relatives in the Charleston aristocracy. Black political activism. Most African Americans across the country had become strong supporters of Franklin D. Roosevelt and his New Deal. Many who lived in northern states where blacks could vote abandoned the party of Abraham Lincoln and voted Democratic. A few black South Carolina citizens had gone through the difficult and dangerous process of registering to vote in the general elections, but they were excluded by law from voting in the Democratic primary, the only meaningful election. In 1944, a small group of them organized the SC Progressive Democratic Party, PDP. They were led by John McCrae, editor of the Columbia Lighthouse and Informer, and Osceola McCain. The PDP tried in vain to gain recognition from the National Democratic Party. Despite rejection, the PDP remained fiercely loyal to Democratic presidential nominees. Attacking the all-white primary. Blacks had more success with court challenges to the all-white Democratic primary. In a landmark 1944 case, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled the Texas Democratic Party's all-white primary unconstitutional. In response, South Carolina repealed 147 laws requiring the primary and approved constitutional amendments separating party primaries from state government. Now the state could argue that the party was a private club and was not subject to the equality requirements of the U.S. Constitution. George A. Elmore of Columbia and the NAACP challenged this version of the all-white primary in federal court in 1947. Judge Waring shocked Carolinians in his Elmore v. Rice decision with a strong affirmation of blacks' right to vote in Democratic primaries because primaries were the only real elections. Waring declared, "It is time for South Carolina to rejoin the Union. It is time to fall in step with the other states and adopt the American way of conducting elections." Democrats tried again to save the white primary. They required that anyone voting in the primary had to swear an oath that they supported segregation and white supremacy. Judge Waring threw out the oath in 1948. About 35,000 blacks registered to vote, and most voted in the Democratic primary that year. They only composed about 5% of the voters, but it was a start. Efforts to open higher education to blacks. Colleges and universities, like other schools, were rigidly segregated. Many African Americans wanted to change that pattern. In 1946, John Wrighton filed suit in the U.S. District Court to gain admission to the USC School of Law. Judge Waring ordered the state to admit black students to the USC Law School or provide an equal opportunity for blacks. State officials chose to set up a new law school at State College in Orangeburg. That school opened in 1947 and for several years trained many of the lawyers who would argue civil rights cases in South Carolina for decades. These lawyers included Ernest Finney, later Chief Justice of South Carolina, and Matthew Perry. The state would successfully keep blacks out of all white colleges for another 16 years. White-on-black violence intensifies. In the 2 years after World War II, racial violence spread across the South. Black GIs came home from war more determined than ever to maintain some semblance of citizenship rights. Southern whites were just as determined to maintain white supremacy. South Carolina did not escape this white-on-black violence. There were many minor incidents, but two in particular brought national shame to the state. The beating of Isaac Woodard, Jr. Isaac Woodard, Jr. was discharged in 1946 from the Army in Georgia and was traveling by bus through South Carolina to meet his wife in North Carolina. He and the bus driver got into an argument that resulted in Woodard being tossed off the bus into the waiting arms of the Batesburg police. The lawmen beat the prisoner so severely that he became totally and permanently blind. Heavyweight boxing champ Joe Louis hosted a fundraising event in New York City for Woodard. Folk singer Woody Guthrie wrote and sang The Blinding of Isaac Woodard for the benefit. Actor Orson Welles helped convince the FBI to investigate the beating, which resulted in the arrest and trial in federal court of the Batesburg police chief. The defense counsels blasted the federal government for intervening in a local matter and warned that conviction of the chief would tell white Carolinians that their homes and children would not be safe. An all-white jury acquitted the chief. The murder of Willie Earle. The second violent act that had a sensational effect on the nation was the murder of Willie Earle in 1947. Soon after this young Greenville black man took a cab ride, the driver was found dead. Earle was arrested and taken to jail. The following day, 35 cab drivers forcibly removed Earle from jail. He was beaten, horribly mutilated, and shot. Governor J. Strom Thurmond denounced the crime and ordered a thorough investigation by state officials. But no arrests were made until the FBI investigated and got 26 men to admit in writing that they were involved. The trial of 31 suspects was watched nationwide and in the White House. After a 10-day trial, the all-white jury acquitted all 31 men. The murder of Willie Earle was the last known racial killing in South Carolina. The murder energized many blacks and stiffened their resolve for equality. It also energized the federal government. The unjust verdict played a role in President Harry S. Truman's decision to present a strong civil rights legislative program to the Congress. It also helped influence Truman's Democratic Party to adopt a liberal platform on civil rights in 1948. The Dixiecrat Movement Against Civil Rights. The Democratic Party's equal rights proposals in 1948 led many white Southerners to abandon the party. Many who wanted to maintain the Jim Crow system formed the States' Rights Democratic Party, more commonly called the Dixiecrat Party. They chose as their leader and presidential candidate J. Strom Thurmond, the governor of South Carolina. Thurmond had been a state judge when he volunteered for service in the war. He returned home a hero and ran for governor in 1946 as a progressive Democrat. As governor, Thurmond encouraged women's involvement in government and appointed a few blacks to school boards. He advocated spending more money on education, added a 12th grade, and extended the school year to 9 months. He insisted on vigorous prosecution of Willie Earle's murderers and supported repeal of the poll tax. As the Dixiecrat candidate for president in 1948, Thurmond stood strongly for segregation and states' rights. To the States' Rights Democratic Convention, he said, "I want to tell you that there's not enough troops in the Army to force the Southern people to break down segregation and admit the Negro into our theaters, into our swimming pools, into our homes, and into our churches." Thurmond won the electoral votes of 4 Deep South states, Alabama, Louisiana, Mississippi, and South Carolina. Democratic President Truman won the election, but it was the first crack in the solid Democratic South since Reconstruction. The Crusade Against Segregated Schools. By the end of the 1940s, black parents in Clarendon County were engaged in a dramatic lawsuit that challenged segregation of public schools. In their tiny school district, white schools were worth 4 times as much as black schools, yet there were 3 times as many black students. White elementary teachers averaged 28 pupils, black teachers averaged 47. White schools had hot lunches, janitors, gyms, and flush toilets. Black schools had none of these. The county spent $166 per white child and $43 per black child. The white children were brought to school in the county's 30 buses. No transportation was provided for black children. Black parents first sued to get bus transportation for their children, some of whom were walking 9 miles to school. Following Judge Waring's advice, the parents challenged the constitutionality of the entire segregated educational system, and thus was created the first all-out assault on the system of racial segregation of public schools in the Deep South. The legal suit known as Briggs v. Elliott was brought by 20 Clarendon County parents and was handled by Thurgood Marshall and his team of NAACP lawyers. As it made its way through the federal court system, it was combined with four other cases from different states. All were decided by the Supreme Court under the title of Brown v. Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas, in 1954. The Whites' Response to Clarendon Black Activism. Clarendon County black citizens knew well the probable consequences of legally attacking the system of segregation. Getting the 20 persons to sign up for the case had taken several months of intense persuasion by Reverend J. A. Delane, a pastor and teacher. All the courageous parents who took that risk suffered from their decision. Harry Briggs, a service station employee, and his wife Liza, a motel maid, both lost their jobs. The local bank in Somerton cut off their credit. Several other signers suffered the same fates. Some were ousted from their rented homes. The Delane family suffered mightily for the Reverend's activism. Delane, his wife Maddie, and several relatives were fired from their teaching jobs. Delane was threatened, driven off the highway more than once, and sued for slander. For his safety, the AME Church transferred him out of the county. Soon his empty house in Clarendon County was burned. The harassment continued in the Delane's new home in Lake City. His church was burned. Night riders shot into his home on several occasions. He finally fired back. Law enforcement issued a warrant for his arrest for assault with intent to kill. He and his family escaped from the state, and he was never able to return. Governor Burns's response to Briggs v. Elliott. The grand strategist for South Carolina's response to the challenge to segregation was James F. Burns, who had no trouble winning election as governor in 1950. Now he was confronted with the greatest challenge to the Southern way of life since Reconstruction. Governor Burns recognized the gross inequalities existing between the two state school systems. He calculated that the best way to maintain segregation was to make the black and white school facilities as nearly equal as possible. Improving black schools. Burns convinced the General Assembly to make a great leap toward equal facilities. The state instituted a 3% sales tax to raise some $75 million to spend mainly on improvement of schools for blacks. That the legislature would make such a commitment is a measure of the stature of Jimmy Burns and the fear of federal court intervention. Astonishing changes occurred. The state built new schools, repaired old ones, transported black students to schools, and gave black and white teachers equal pay. The state system was made more efficient by consolidating 1,200 school districts into 102. The legislature established a special committee to steer efforts to prevent school desegregation. Chaired by Senator L. Marion Grasset, the committee proved inventive in avoiding the effects of federal law and court decisions. The state constitution was amended to remove the requirement that the state provide a public school system. The legislature authorized school districts to sell schools so they could be run by private groups such as churches. The state never took the drastic step of abolishing its state-supported schools. The Brown v. Board of Education decision, 1954. After all the arguments were in on the case of Brown v. Board of Education, Chief Justice Earl Warren spoke to the other eight justices about the essence of the case. At the human heart of the issue, he believed, was this fact. The only justification for segregation of the races was the belief in the inferiority of black people. On May 17, 1954, Warren announced an amazing unanimous decision that reversed Plessy v. Ferguson. The court declared that separate educational facilities are inherently unequal. Therefore, separate schools violated the 14th Amendment's requirement of equality under the law. In a follow-up decision, the court ordered states to desegregate their schools with all deliberate speed. That phrase would be used in some states to push the desegregation process forward and in others to delay the process for as long as possible. White Carolinians' response to Brown. South Carolina's white political leadership and white newspapers were bitter in their opposition to the Supreme Court's decision. Governor Burns led the Southern governors in planning and implementing a massive resistance to the new law of the land. Senator Strom Thurmond was the chief author of the Southern Manifesto, signed by most Southern congressmen, which condemned the Supreme Court for substituting naked power for established law. It urged use of, quote, all lawful means to bring about a reversal of this decision, which is contrary to the Constitution, and to prevent the use of force in its implementation, end quote. The General Assembly responded by repealing the compulsory school attendance law. It required the cutoff of funds from any white school that accepted a black student by court order and from that student's former school. If black students were admitted to a public white college by court order, all state funds to South Carolina State College at Orangeburg would be cut off. To discourage blacks from applying to white colleges for advanced degrees, the legislature provided free tuition and traveling expenses for students to attend universities in the North, even Ivy League institutions. South Carolina was willing to pay a high price for maintaining segregation. George Bell Timmerman, Jr. became governor in January 1955 and led attacks on the Brown decision and on the notion that any desegregation was going to take place within 1,000 years. Governor Timmerman joined the chorus of those who equated civil rights activism with communism. He warned the state Democratic Convention in 1956 that freedom is endangered by those who wish, quote, to destroy constitutional government and to invade rights of the states and their people. Racial mixing in the South is a very real and very meaningful part of the communist conspiracy, end quote. The difficult years in the wake of Brown. The remaining years of the 1950s after the Brown decision were difficult for South Carolina. Most white people felt their way of life was threatened and white supremacy was endangered. Most black people were frustrated that court decisions had been made and laws changed, but their lives were not yet any better. In Orangeburg County, several dozen African-American parents signed a petition in 1955 requesting admission of their children to white schools. The white response was quick and very tough on the signers. The Orangeburg Boycott. Whites used economic pressure to try to force the petitioners back in line. Orangeburg Mayor W.J. Deer explained that the tactic was to starve NAACP members and anyone who protested Jim Crow. Whites should, he said, quote, fire all petitioners, fire all members of their families, force them to move out of the community, deny them credit, boycott anybody who helps them in any way, end quote. Economic intimidation was such a powerful tool for whites because most blacks worked for white bosses, rented property from whites, and depended on credit at white-owned stores. About half the signers had to remove their names from the petition. But black leaders realized they also had some economic clout. Blacks composed about half the population of the county. Many white businesses were dependent on trade from the black community. Orangeburg blacks organized a counter-boycott, refusing to do business with the whites who supported the boycott. With the help of funds raised by the NAACP and the National Council of Churches, the black boycotters held out for a year. The two sides finally arranged an uneasy peace, but both sides remained determined. No school desegregation took place. White Citizens' Councils. The opposition to school desegregation and any change in racial policy was led in most communities by white citizens' councils. This movement originated in Mississippi in 1954, took root in Orangeburg County in 1955, and then spread rapidly across South Carolina. By mid-1956, frustrated and angry whites had created a state association and 55 local citizens' councils. The Charleston News and Courier had become the unofficial mouthpiece of the movement. The council claimed tens of thousands as members. They believed that respectable Southern white people were the best friends black people had. The councils were much more active and popular in South Carolina than the Ku Klux Klan, whose members had been unmasked by law in the early 1950s. The prominent businessmen who led the councils gave an air of respectability. However, the councils used anti-black language similar to the Klan and had similar purposes: the maintenance of white supremacy, of racial segregation, and of constitutional government. The council's means of achieving their purposes were less violent. They included legal maneuvers, political action, education against race mixing, and economic intimidation. The council's activities peaked in 1956 and then began to decline. Maine statewide leaders, Emory Rogers and Micah Jenkins, retired from the organization by 1957, and the councils were never the same. They lingered into the 1960s, but membership dwindled to only several hundred. Other voices. Other voices were speaking out on racial matters. African American churches and ministers, the backbone of South Carolina's black community, had worked for advancement of black people. Many, but not all, had advocated equal rights with whites. Some feared that pushing for true equality would anger white people and make conditions worse for blacks. In the 1950s, most black churches supported the Supreme Court's decision in Brown v. Board of Education, but some were more enthusiastic than others. A few white people took courageous stands for desegregation. Three organizations included both whites and blacks and worked cautiously for more racial justice. The Christian Action Council was under the leadership of Reverend Howard McLean, a white Baptist minister. Church Women United was led for many years by Edith Dabbs, a white Maysville woman. Both organizations, which included churches of different denominations, both black and white, gently nudged their members to a higher consciousness about racial injustices. A third integrated organization, the South Carolina Council on Human Relations, SCCHR, was led by a white executive director, Alice Spearman. The major white Southern essayist, poet, and theologian, James McBride Dabbs of Maysville, was president several times. The SCCHR provided an opportunity for blacks and whites to meet together and to work toward racial and economic justice within a biracial society. Like the other two organizations, its successes depended on walking a thin line between moving too fast to be effective with whites or moving too slow to be attractive to blacks. A few individual whites spoke out in support of desegregation in the mid-50s. They usually suffered for their trouble. Reverend Jackson Stafford believed the Brown decision was, quote, in keeping with the constitutional guarantee of equal freedom to all citizens and in harmony with the Christian principles of equal justice and love for all men, end quote. Stafford was pastor of Governor Timmerman's home church, the First Baptist Church of Batesburg. Expression of such sentiments was not acceptable, and Stafford was forced to resign. Claudia Sanders of Gaffney joined several other moderate whites in publishing a little book of essays titled Concerned South Carolinians, recommending modest changes. Several members of the local Klan blew out the side of her home with dynamite. Dr. Chester Travelstead, dean of the USC School of Education, spoke out boldly against segregation in education. Under pressure from the governor's office, the university fired the dean. The Civil Rights Act of 1957. Advocates for civil rights had a difficult job in the South, but the federal government had gradually begun to intervene. The federal courts had equalized teacher pay, opened the Democratic primary, and ordered schools to desegregate. And in 1959, the court was to rule segregation unconstitutional in interstate transportation, buses, and trains. The presidency became committed to civil rights when Harry S. Truman ordered the desegregation of the armed forces in 1948, a very powerful use of presidential authority that had great impact. The third branch of government, Congress, was slowest to respond to racial inequalities, but it considered a bill in 1957. Though it was a weak bill, a committee of South Carolina politicians urged senators to filibuster the bill. Senator Strom Thurmond set a record for a one-man filibuster, 24 hours and 18 minutes. The bill passed anyway. The Civil Rights Act of 1957 was the first one passed by Congress since Reconstruction. The act established the Civil Rights Commission with authority to investigate conditions of race relations and possible violation of legal rights. It also set up the Civil Rights Division within the U.S. Department of Justice. All three branches of the federal government had now committed to the concept of racial equality. Do you remember? 1. Define in sentence form, Dixiecrat Party, Southern Manifesto, White Citizens' Councils. 2. Who was Thurgood Marshall, and why did he visit South Carolina many times in the 1940s? 3. What was the result of Judge J. Wade Waring's decision in the Elmore v. Rice case? The following is a summary of Chapter 14. The whole world suffered through a decade of depression, which gave rise to extreme nationalist parties in Italy, Germany, and Japan in the 1930s. These parties promised prosperity and national greatness through aggressive foreign policy. By 1939, war had broken out in Europe as Germany began invading neighboring countries. As had been the case after the outbreak of World War I in Europe, the United States tried to maintain neutrality in this Second World War. When the Japanese attacked the U.S. naval fleet anchored at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, the United States found itself once again fighting in a global war. The war would last until 1945 and would bring about many changes for the world, including the introduction of nuclear warfare. The strong economy of the war years continued, but some aspects of society remained the same. Prejudice and discrimination were still widespread in South Carolina and the rest of the country, with the ideology of communism offering hope to some countries devastated by war. The United States found itself heading into a Cold War with the Soviet Union and the countries it was taking over.